This is Crozier Vision. The following podcast was recorded on Monday, the 2nd of April 2007, and features Brian Micklethwaite and me, Patrick Crozier, discussing the works of Immanuel Todd.
Okay, Brian, first question. Immanuel Todd, who is he?
Well, he's a French anthropologist and historian, and very elderly people may remember a man called Olivier Todd, who used to speak in a very cultured, one of those perfect English accents which just has a touch of Frenchness that makes it even seem even more grand, who used to talk a lot on the BBC in the sort of 1960s, that kind of era.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the father of Immanuel Todd. So Immanuel Todd is a French academic, but not as we know them, in that he had a very Anglophile background, intellectually speaking. He has a very Anglophobic foreground, as far as I can see. But for a long time, he was highly sympathetic to the Anglo-Saxon attitude and culture, and in some ways he still is.
Right.
But and that's who he is. He must have been born in about 1950-ish, some sort of time like that. He's a bit younger than me.
So he's still with us.
Oh yeah, very much so. Very much so. He's now about 50 something, I think. That's roughly what he is.
Right, and he has a couple of big ideas.
Well, he's written a succession of books, and the two that have impressed the daylights out of me are a book called The Explanation of Ideology, which was published I can't remember the exact dates, but I should explain before I go any further that I have already done three blog postings on my personal blog, brianmicklethwaite.com. At the bottom on the left, there is a list of categories, one of which is Immanuel Todd. That's how that's how seriously I take this man. Mm-hmm. And if you click on that and read things there, I've done three postings so far, you will get all the coherence and factual backup that is missing from what I'm about to say.
Mm-hmm.
But the things like the dates of publications and all that are all there. But the two books that most impressed me, I picked them up in remainder shops in the 1980s in English translations, and I've possessed them ever since. The first is called The Explanation of Ideology, subtitle Family Structures and Social Systems, and the second one is called The Causes of Progress, Culture, Authority and Change. And those are the two books which most struck me and still do most strike me. I think together they present one of the most breathtakingly original and remarkable grand theories of history that I've ever read. And I suspect, I'm hesitant to be certain, because one can get carried away with these things, but I suspect that it combines scope and excellence to a remarkable degree. That's to say, it explains an awful lot about the modern history, more than any other grand theory of modern history, and that it's actually correct. That's my guess.
That seems quite a sort of frightening claim. One doesn't like things to be cut and dry quite so easily.
Yes, and it is a fiercely reductionist theory of history as well, because, you will have noted, if you're listening, the singular, the explanation of ideology. I mean, come on.
Yes.
Not even an S. I mean, at least he puts an S after the causes of progress. He acknowledges there might be...
I should point out to the listeners, as Brian is pointing out these books...
I have them in hardback. The explanation of ideology. Well, I'll sketch it as best I can.
Not one of them, but...
First of all, we all grow up in what he describes as different family structures. There are... He maps the world into eight different types of place, according to its anthropological system. Number eight is the African one, which is a bit like a dustbin. He doesn't really know what's going on in there, but he just describes them as African systems. It gets very complicated. But the other seven are various different family systems, and I can't even remember them. We'll get to the fact that I'm not really the right person to be doing this in the first place.
But in essence, there's an Anglo-Saxon one.
Yes, that's the absolute nuclear family. Which is inegalitarian. I can't even remember all the words. But there's the Anglo-Saxon one. There's the communist one, which is the community family, I think it is. That's the exogamous community family. Then there's a Muslim one. Then there's a social democracy one.
And there are a couple in Europe, aren't there?
There's several in Europe. There's the absolute nuclear, which is England. There's the authoritarian, which is Germany, Sweden, Scotland. Interestingly, that Scotland,
Japan as well.
Japan as well, yes. Korea. The only country in North Central or South America which has the communist, this is the thing that really impressed me, the communist family system, as you might call it, is Cuba. Mm-hmm. And I remember being very struck when Todd was asked in the 1980s, will Nicaragua go communist? Everybody else was very frightened that it would. No, he announced, it will not.
Mm-hmm.
I am able to tell you this. And he was right. I mean, he said it doesn't have the right anthropology to go communist. And it won't.
Now, when we talk about anthropology, there are three elements to this, the categorisation. One is the rights of inheritance.
Well, there are lots of elements to it. The relationship between siblings is very important. The relationship between children and parents is very important. The relationship between husbands and wives is very important. Inheritance laws illuminate the equality or lack of it between siblings. So that, for example, in the authoritarian family, all the property goes to the eldest son. I think that's, mm-hmm. I think that's how it works. In the egalitarian families, it's divided up equally.
Mm-hmm.
In the absolute, I don't know what absolute means for these purposes, but in the English system, it's you can make it up as you go along. You can do it any way you like. It's not egalitarian in the sense you're obliged to divide it. It's not authoritarian in the sense you're obliged to give it all to the eldest son.
But in one of your blog postings, you were describing Emmanuel Todd's classification.
Yes.
And the rules were, first of all, inheritance. If you can make up your own rules of inheritance, like you can in the Anglo-Saxon world, or actually land.
Yes.
And other. You can't. You can't. Is you divided can't, equally.
Yeah. Custom or law simply overrides you. You are obliged to do it the way it's done, as it were.
Mm-hmm. I mean, another aspect I thought was really odd was, does the heir live with his parents?
Yes. The question of living, if you live with your father into your adult life, what that means is that adults can still be bossed by their parents. And the other one is exogamy and endogamy. Do you marry out of your family, or do you marry within your clan, as it were? Do you marry your cousin, or are you forbidden to marry your cousin? That's mm-hmm. what that's about. And in the Muslim family...
are there other versions where you must marry your cousin?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Crikey.
The endogamous family, you are obliged to... You mustn't marry outside your clan. And that has enormous consequences for your view of the world. And your view of where strangers fit in and how easily it is to get on with strangers. Not easy at all is the basic assumption mm-hmm. you grow up with. Now, what Todd asserts, he asserts two things about this. First, he says it doesn't change. It's very important to understand that family structure doesn't change from century to century. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, what he does is he takes the work of Alan McFarlane, who wrote a book called The Origins of English Individualism, where... he took the Marxist assumption that individualism was arrived at a certain point in history, perhaps because of economic forces, industrialization or something like that. So he starts at the present and he goes back and back and back and says, when did English individualism start? And he keeps going back and he keeps finding it. He keeps finding the same old battles between sons and fathers, which the sons win because they're entitled, basically, because the culture says they are.
Mm-hmm.
Marrying for love, strangers... and being the parents raging about it and having no power over them. He goes back and back and back, and he keeps on finding these stories, these anecdotes, these historical records of rows between generations and inequality between children and people being allowed to go off and do things that their parents disapprove of. And he ends up by saying, it's before my time. I can't tell you about the origins of English individualism.
I mean, how far does he go back? I mean, does he go back to the Anglo-Saxon chronicles, or does he go back to the Celtic?
I don't know how far he goes back, but he goes back a long, long way. And the point is, he says, the English anthropological system has not changed in the last 1,000 or more years. And what Todd does is to generalise that and say, that applies to everybody in the world. Everybody has their own particular anthropological system, and it doesn't change. Now, the next thing he says is that politics... the kind of politics that in our particular case takes the form of radical Anglo-Saxon individualism, is the projection of your family structure onto the realm of public affairs. And so what you think about your father's proper role in life is what you think about the state's proper role. What you think about the relationship between citizens is learned from what you've been told about the relationship between brothers,
mm-hmm.
for example. And what you've been told to believe about strangers, politically, you know, whether you can get along with people from the other side of the world,
mm-hmm.
is based on, for example, whether you're in the habit of marrying them or not. You see, it absolutely, I was going to say cripples, but it certainly makes politics in the Middle East very different, that they have no tradition of forming alliances when there is a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
A marriage in our culture is two families.
And what Todd would say from that is that they tend to mistrust strangers.
They tend to have an us-them view of the world, which starts with us, our family.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how he would. I don't know whether he'd phrase it quite like that, but the point is that your ideological, the dominant ideology in any particular part of the world will be determined by the anthropological system, by the family structure. And the important thing to understand about family structure is that it means the things that don't change. It doesn't mean the particular circumstances of your particular family and the number of brothers and sisters you happen to have and the fact that your father died when you were young or something like that. It means the things that don't change. It's the sort of ideal that you and I both share, because we're both members of the same anthropological setup, about how things should be. We believe that as adults we are expected to live, to stand on our own feet, and I remember it, my father once told me to get my hair cut when I was 26, and I told him not to put too fine a point on it, to go forth and multiply,
mm-hmm.
in not exactly those words. And the point is, the culture backed me. The culture says I'm entitled to say that. Whereas if I'd done that in Japan, it would have been the opposite. I wouldn't be allowed to say that to my father. I would have got my hair cut. And that has a profound effect on the different ideological place that is given to the state.
Okay, so that's a theory. Family structure determines. Now, what does he mean by ideology? Because, say in the last century, Britain has gone through various ideological changes. It never went communist, but it has.
I know. I think, in my opinion, Todd is at his strongest when he is explicating what happens to political systems during the switch from minority literacy to majority literacy and the associated political turmoil.
This is the other side.
Yes. Literacy is the trigger. Literacy is what turns family structure beliefs into political beliefs, because literacy basically empowers the masses. It makes them people whose opinions count.
Hang about, but if Macfarlane is true, he's right. Then literacy presumably sort of 1,000 years ago was fairly low.
Very low.
But yet the political system was. There was a Witten and the Parliament, and he talks about the idea of the English individual. It sounds rather similar. If you take away the technology, it sounds rather similar.
We had our Civil War, and everybody does. The Germans had it first because their literacy was the highest. They were the first mass literate nation in the world, I think.
This is the 13 Years' War.
Yes. You have a fight between the. You see, it's not so much. Start again. The Civil War is between the people who assert the beliefs of the masses and those who assert that the beliefs of the masses don't matter. That's not how things should be. You know, the king is what matters, or the aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
Always there's an aristocracy versus the masses element. But what the masses are saying, or what their leaders are saying, is different in each case. That's the sense. Aristocracy versus the mob is universal. The saying, what the mob is saying, is different each time, depending on the anthropological system. Now, even as I speak and stutter and fumble, I'm deeply aware of the fact that I'm not doing a very good job of explaining this guy's thinking. That's one of the reasons I thank goodness for blogs, because there I can write it down and people can read it. I don't have to be able to publish articles in journals. And at this point, before I finish this talk, I want to say that my principal objective is not directly to explicate Todd's ideas. It is to find out if anybody else is doing it. And if not, why not? I want to connect with any academics who can answer the question, what impression has Todd made on the academic world, and especially the English-speaking academic world? When I Google for Todd, I get lots of stuff in French. I mean, he's quite a big cheese in French intellectual political life.
Yeah.
He's interviewed by the newspapers. He's the director of...
It doesn't sound good, by the way, that sounds...
I know. All the Anglo-Saxon prejudices about French intellectuals ought to swing into action. And yet, despite all that, I just find it so interesting and potentially so true. It all seems to me to make such good sense. And I want to know if anybody else knows about this guy. In particular, I would like to know if there's been any academic response. I'm not an academic myself. I don't know most of the other academics.
Well,
I don't know
some sort of reasonably good non-academic response would be.
Mm. But I think it's possible that Todd's basic narrative, his basic grand theory, is true, but that he has pissed in his own pot so violently that the people in the English-speaking world won't have anything to do with him. You get the feeling from reading his books that he's a very arrogant, very dismissive sort of individual. And there is an even deeper problem than this, which is that built into his theory is a kind of put-down of all political intellectuals. He's saying, you think what you think because you were brought up that way. It's nothing to do with choice. It's simply that you are that way.
Well, it's a hell of a put-down to us libertarians.
Oh, it is.
Here we are trying to change the world through ideas. Right. And he's saying,
forget it. Well, part of what appealed to me about Todd was that he was answering the question, why am I doing so badly? You know, he explained why ideas can only get so far in the world, why Islam can only spread so far, and then it meets these invisible barriers where the family system that it thrives on stops.
Mm-hmm.
One of Todd's particular beefs is that during the Cold War, Americans and Russians tended to structure the global political debate as between two camps.
Yes.
And Todd, I think, like a lot of French people, sees himself as speaking for the, first of all, for things like social democracy, which are neither one thing nor the other, and also for things like the Indian political systems and of course, Islam, and just all the people who got left out of that communist versus radical individualist story. That the Russians and the
South
Americans...
South American strongmen. And,
all sorts of... Yes, all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. Who got left out of that story. And I think perhaps that's where his rage against Anglo-Saxon people starts. Their mania, as he sees it, for reducing a much more complicated and interesting story consisting of minimum of 8 different narratives into just 2, namely good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom versus communism, you know.
Yes.
He finds that... over excessively reductionist, I think. But he is himself a reductionist, and he's not only fairly dismissive of, Anglo-Saxon liberals, deluded, imagining they can spread their opinions to the whole world, forget it, mate, it's not going to work, but he dismisses communists in a few sentences. He just says... there's an amazing passage in... I think it's the Explanation of Ideology, where he says that communists are very well organised... so if their vote gets to 40%, they take over the country and they wreck it, and there's nothing anyone can do about this, which kind of insults everybody, doesn't it? It certainly insults the communists. You're psychos, you're lunatic monsters, you ruin every country you get your fangs into, but everybody else is kind of insulted as being, you know, ineffectual and ridiculous and unable to stop this disaster. So you can forget the communists, they're never going to support him. However vaguely sympathetic to the USSR, you're not going to have any liking for Todd. I get the feeling that the man has just pissed in every intellectual pot on the planet, and that might explain why he's ignored by so many people. That might explain it. It might be that the grand theory is essentially true, but that too many people just don't like it. And he's been rude to too many people as well, one suspects. But I don't know, and I would like to know.
I was just thinking that I'm sure there are plenty of very rude academics who still get a good press. I mean, maybe it's... but with academic economics.
I think that the smart academics, the sort of the clever ones, are not rude to absolutely everybody. And I suspect Todd is probably rude to almost everyone. I don't know. I want to find out.
But your point is you can't find any holes, or it's difficult.
I can't, but that proves nothing. I mean, I'm not an anthropologist. I'm useless at dealing with complicated piles of statistics, which is what you'd need to blow it to bits. I like simplicity. What appeals to me about the theory is its simplicity. This to many crass reductionism of it all is what I find so appealing. It reduces history to a few variables.
I mean, can I possibly suggest some holes? Because I did notice that he lumped in Vietnam, whole of Southeast Asia, with Thailand and I think Malaysia as well, as all having the same system. But what was striking about there is whereas a whole bunch of them went communists in the 70s, Thailand and Malaysia did not and didn't come even close. Hang about Malaysia, they had an emergency.
I think his view of communism is that when it conquers another country, that other country is liable to stay conquered for quite some time. Because the communists are so ruthless, I'm sure there are lots of little corners of the world where it just doesn't make sense, but far too many where it does, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, the one that got my attention was Cuba. I remember being very struck by that. I think he's done a great deal to explain not only the fact of Cuba going communist, but its relentless persistence.
Because it has exactly the same family structure as the Soviet
Union. Where I think he's weaker is talking about history after all these dramas have taken place, which, by the way, leads on to the next question, which is the causes of progress. Todd's view of progress and economic development in particular is that it's simply the application of literacy to economic questions as opposed to political questions. That's what economic development is. It's not a question of economic development being helped by literacy. That's what it is. You're missing the point. Economic development is cultural development. It's not factories and ploughs and aeroplanes. That is the epiphenomenon of the thing itself. The thing itself is what happens in people's minds. That's it.
They're reading plays and just learning more about all sorts of different things.
Well, for example, keeping a diary, you know, being organised. And as far as men are concerned, it's economic life. As far as women are concerned, it's their fertility. Women get literate. Women get control of the number of children they have. So that you have a demographic bulge when economic development starts and they can afford to feed themselves and have more children. And then you get into economic decline when the women get control of how many children they have.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this rise and fall. And all sorts of people get panic-stricken when they see the first part of that graph and they extrapolate it and think, oh my God, these people are breeding like rabbits and they're going to conquer us all. But they don't see that it's going to decline. So that all the world over the last 50 years has been full of, in fact, longer than that, has been full of prophecies of triumph and of doom based on extrapolating graphs which Todd is able to tell us, relax, it's not going to go on like that. Japan was a good example. Japanese fertility has plummeted. And he says, for example, the Arab world's fertility will go down. We don't have to be so panic-stricken about that. That's what he says.
I'm trying to relate that to what happened. I mean, in Britain there was a huge increase in fertility in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
But when was the big expansion in literacy? That would have been a couple of centuries beforehand.
Well, the big development. Well, first of all, I mean, I've said, I want to emphasise this. I like the theory because of its essential simplicity. I am not good at handling more than about three things in my brain at one time. I'm not good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is just too much to talk about in Todd. My brain hurts. You know, I just can't handle all the complications and all the different arguments and all the different facts that are involved. And half of the implications I haven't thought through myself. And I just want to know whether it's worth doing, if you see what I mean. You know, if somebody can convince me that it's all nonsense, then I can, thank God, I can just say, oh, good, well, that's the end of that. I can forget about that. My understanding of English economic history is that the important developments occurred earlier than the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big surge in agricultural productivity a couple of centuries before that. And then fertility went down, and then they were able to afford to have more and so on. But I find Todd less convincing when he's talking about... there are two dramas. There's the political drama with the impact of literacy on politics. Then there's the economic drama, which follows later. Both of them caused by literacy.
Yes.
Once the political thing has been sorted, the economic thing can go into action, unimpeded by political derangements.
Mm-hmm.
So you get things like the Cultural Revolution in China. It explodes, it calms down, then the economic story can go into gear. After that, after the economic story has got thoroughly underway, that's when I find Todd less convincing. That's when I think other people start to know at least as much about what's going on as he does. And I think
so. He would have difficulty in explaining, say, the last 100 years of
he
of
has. He's very confident about explaining all kinds of things, but I have the strong sense that he's simply that if things had gone quite differently, he'd have been equally confident explaining that. If you see what I mean, he's post-rationalizing when it comes to things like Nazi Germany. He's got lots of descriptions of what happened under Nazi Germany, which make a lot of sense to him, but I think he's just mapping what we know happened onto his system of thought, his way of thinking, rather than using his way of thinking, as it were, to predict Nazi Germany.
Because it seems to me to be just so far past what he's talking about.
He's
talking about literacy.
Exactly. I think he overstates the usefulness of his grand narrative. But it has many virtues still in the modern world, because there are plenty of parts of the world where literacy is at exactly the stage he's talking about, and where China, we just mentioned it, which has its political eruptions culminating in the Cultural Revolution, and then this extraordinary economic miracle. I mean, he's adamant, for example, that Asia economic success is because of literacy being quite high in that part of the world, and Africa, it's much lower. So he was saying, I mean, I took his original writings to be, when I read them in the 80s, as a prediction that Asia would do economically much better than Africa. Well, I think he's been proved right. Yes. So there are plenty of circumstances which he is very well able to illuminate. And just because he doesn't illuminate everything doesn't mean it's not a mightily impressive edifice.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, my principal objective, I mean, if you get only one message from this rather incoherent conversation that we're having, please read the blog entries. And if you know anything about what people have said, in the English-speaking world especially, please get in touch.
Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you.